I can't tell you how excited I am to have the Tweeties here. I don't mean to call attention to it, but I'm gonna, because I'm excited, and I know others are too. But we understand. So we are in Isaiah. We are in Isaiah chapters 13 through 24. That's right. Isaiah 13 through 24. Isaiah has spoken of Assyria's future, Israel's future, and the future glorified eternal kingdom. He's already talked about these things. He's not done. He'll come back to it. But now Isaiah is going to speak about the rest of the world kingdoms at the time. Isaiah is not alone in addressing the world kingdoms here. Here are the world kingdoms all up and down. Isaiah obviously covers a lot of them. Jeremiah is going to deal with a lot of them. Ezekiel is going to deal with a lot of them. Amos already dealt with a lot of them. And then we have some over here. So he's not alone. And from this alone, if we can draw a necessary inference from this and understand that God is paying attention to all the nations. Now, there is a lot. Let me underscore that. Watch. A lot. There is a lot in this text, in this section, that I just do not know. I just don't know. In fact, when I was reading the three commentaries that I was reading, they all said, perhaps, maybe this, maybe that. Maybe it wasn't this, maybe it was that, maybe it was perhaps that. And when they do that, I think to myself, it's time to put down the commentary because I'm not getting anywhere with this. And so that's what I've done. Now, some people can go through this text and expose it a lot more efficiently and effectively than I can, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to cover some things that I know I can know. So that's what we're going to do with this section here, instead of guessing about things that will not build up our faith. For example, in chapter 22, verse 15, thus says the Lord God of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. What right do you have here? And whom do you have here? That you have hewn a tomb for yourself here. You who hew a tomb on the height. You who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock. Behold, the Lord is about to hurl you headlong, O man, and he is about to grasp you firmly and roll you tightly like a ball to be cast into a vast country. There you will die, and there your splendid chariots will be. You shame of your master's house. I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him. I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set a key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will come to the throne of glory to his father's house. So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of the vessels, from the bowls to all the jars. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give away. It will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken. Now, here are some questions I have about this text. First of all, who in the world is Shebna? Secondly, what exactly did Shebna do wrong? Now, we can have some guesses, and we can know a little bit more about Shebna. But we'll ask, also, who is Eliakim, and what exactly did he do it right? Oh, suddenly he's being talked about, and he's his servant, and we know he's going to get a promotion. Now, verse 25. Who is the peg in verse 25? So he's going to remove Shebna and put Eliakim in Shebna's place, and Eliakim is going to become a peg. And then verse 25, in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give away. So this peg that's driven into a firm place is now breaking and giving away. Is that Eliakim? Is that Shebna? Homer Haley thinks it's Eliakim. Jim McWeegan thinks that it's Shebna, and Haley thinks that it's the whole Mosaic system. I just don't know. I don't know. Does anybody in here know? If you can tell me, then we can put this thing to rest. But if not, and I'm not talking about just guess. If you'd like to guess, we can have a guessing session. But I don't know. That's all I'll tell you. If you can find somebody who does know, go ask them. But what I can know from this section, this is Isaiah's only prophecy against an individual. Shebna. That's kind of scary. He's calling this man out by name. So God is paying attention to individuals, knows what individuals are doing, and will call attention to them. Now, I don't know about you, but that makes me nervous because I am an individual. And there's God. God is out here, and he's paying attention to every individual. And he is going to call attention to you and to me and to your deeds and to my deeds. So the question is, what about me? Here's Eliakim and Shebna, and God's looking at both of them. And he says, Shebna, no. Eliakim, yes. Now that's 2,000 years ago, more. What about me? What is God doing now? He's looking at me. Is he saying yes to Lee? Well, I hope so. Also, if you are already serving God, he says, my servant Eliakim, my servant right now, he will use you when the time comes. I will say, here's my servant now, and in the time in the future, I'm going to take my servant who is serving me now, and I'm going to use him for something special. If you are already serving God, then God can use you. Well, God will use you anyway, right? But if you're already serving him, following his word, obeying him, then God can say, hey, I can work with that, and I can use that. He's just doing his normal work, and I'm going to use him over here for something specific and something special. If you are already serving God, then he can take you and use you. So what's the question again? What about me? Am I already doing God's work? Some of us, you hear this all the time. I'm working now a real job. Real job. I'm working now a real job. I work a lot of hours. I mean, I work a lot of hours. I work so many hours that it's to the detriment of my faith right now. But I'm working so hard right now to save up so that later I can do more work for God. You've heard it. But God says, look, I need you to be doing my work right now. Do my work now. And let me take care of what you'll do later. If you have a comment or question, raise. Shebna served himself and Eliakim served God. And both were treated accordingly. That's what we see from this passage. So choose wisely. And then God keeps his word. Here he says in chapter 22, Shebna, I'm going to take you and I'm going to give you a demotion and I'm going to give you Eliakim a promotion. And then we read in chapter 36, verse 3, we'll just read the one verse. Chapter 36, verse 3, verse 1. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem to King Hezekiah with a large army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the Fuller's Field. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe. So in chapter 22, he says, look, I'm going to take Shebna and demote him and take Eliakim and promote him. In chapter 36, we see that God's done it. So we know that God keeps his word. Now, there's a lot of stuff that we can guess at in these sections. And there's some stuff that we can just say, hey, I know this, and so let me make this point. And if you would like to be, if you'd like to go more into the guessing, I won't. I'll let you do the guessing, and I'll say only what I can know. Comments or questions on this little short section so far? Okay. So, I asked some questions, and I don't know if you brought both sections of questions. You did. All right, good. So, for Isaiah 13 through 17, the very last question is, what observations and applications can you make from our text? Okay, so you read chapter 13 through 17, and this would apply to all the way up through chapter 22 also. So you read the text, and I asked the question, what applications can you make? What observations? Anybody, anything? Otherwise, I'll do the monologuing. Who wants monologuing? Rob doesn't. Okay, Rob.
I'll throw it out there. I put, when judgment comes, God is complete in his sifting.
Judgment comes?
God is complete in his sifting. In other words, he's going to look.
Are these 3 points or one?
I don't know. Take it out.
I like three. Judgment comes. Yeah. Can't miss that from this section. God is complete. What do you mean? I mean,
just
understand the word.
Everything that he's going to do, he's going to, whatever he says is going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yep.
And then, you know, and his sifting is just he's going to go through everything.
Right. Like that's what we observe.
That's what I got out of that.
Yeah, so now I can sit down because you've just taken all the point of these 10 chapters. Anybody else? Gary. See, that's why we're glad you're here, because I knew you couldn't.
If God judges all the nations of the world, what about us?
Right. Yep. Yep. Yeah. And we see that in here, in chapter 22, that I just read from. I'm judging my people.
One cannot read the Old Testament and not think God's going to judge this nation. You can't.
Our nation, the United States of America. I see.
You can't. If you do, you better grab it again.
Right. Like every other nation.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Anything else? And, you know, we got some time here tonight, so you don't have to share it right now, but please do. Please. So, I have a random thought. Oh, my question number two is, my first question on that same page is, define oracle. Define oracle. Burden or prophecy. Anybody?
I put down a deity-sponsored prediction.
Wow.
Because there's like the oracle at Delphi?
Yes. I have a picture of Nicolai on my shoulders walking down, and he's going like this at Delphi. I don't know why, but he was pretty excited to be there. Yes, God-sponsored?
Deity-sponsored.
Deity. Prediction. Deity.
Yeah.
Okay, so I see what you're saying. Deity can involve?
False stuff.
Yes, okay, very good. Yeah, so, all right. If you look up the word, it's a pronouncement. Okay, it's a pronouncement. The short part of it is, it's a pronouncement. A prophecy, as we understand that word, it's a prophecy. We're not used to dealing with oracle. Okay, that's funny for us. Burden. Okay, we watch on the news all the time. The news segment has to be 32 seconds or less. And so if they're having a debate and they don't finish it, what does the moderator, the host of the news person say? We have to... Anybody? We're going to have to leave it there. All right. So this word burden, I think the New King James uses, or the King James, this word burden, it's like a load. All right. We use the same speech, although we're not used to it. Don't think about it that often. If I say, we get through chapter 15 tonight, I say, next week we will pick up. We'll pick it up in chapter, pick up. What are we going to pick up? What we're going to pick up is something that I have already planned to say. I have already planned to say it. I drop it off. I pick it up next week. In Numbers chapter 23 or something like that, when Balaam comes back from having received revelation from the Lord, he picks up his discourse and says, so it's the same word here, okay? So it's an oracle, it's a pronouncement. I was just explaining, why is it called a burden? Because the root is in there of something lifting something up. All right. So it's a pronouncement. Now, we have to understand something John was hinting at, and that is that false deities also had their oracles. Now, I'm reading a book right now. I just finished a book that you're going to hear a lot about. I hope it's helpful. The reason is because it lets us know about what was happening back then in those days. Now, this man writes... And I'm saying that, look, other nations, they guessed, and this is where we're going with this, concerning pagan oracles, so concerning the false deities' oracles. He writes, it is very important to stress here that the function of an oracle is not to foretell the future, but to give advice. Now, we understand an oracle as something that is more than just advice. It is advice, but it's more than advice. It's telling about the future. He says, look, when you go back there and you read about the Oracle of Delphi, it's not really to predict the future. It's about reading events, what's going on in the times, and being able to interpret it and give the best advice. Now, it is inevitable that if the advice is good, the Oracle will get the reputation for being able to foretell the future. But that is not its function. We turn to experts in politics, economics, and social policy with as little or as much chance of success as the Greeks turned to their oracle. They were just guessing. And that is the difference. Because this oracle is from who?
God.
Right. This oracle is from God. Now, So you can bet that it's going to happen. I'm not advocating for betting. But if I were a betting man, this is what I bet on. If God says something, then it is going to happen. When he says, the oracle concerning Babylon, you know that it's going to happen. Now, what the nations would have given for this kind of information. The oracle at Delphi, why do we know about that? Because everybody back then went there. Because if they wanted to know if the Persians are going to come or what they should do in the Athenians, if they wanted to know how to react or how to act, they went there. And they said, please give us an oracle. But it was just guessing. Could you imagine what one of them would have done if they had picked up Daniel? That would have been like, this is the best thing I've ever read in my life. Except for Alexander the Great. He might not have liked it so much, but, right? Okay. That Israel rejected it. God is giving them messages about the future. Who wouldn't want that? I think I'd want it. I don't know. God gives them messages. The whole world wants messages about the future. God gives it to Israel. And what did they do with it? They chucked it. Thanks, but no thanks. So the question here is, what about me? Am I any better? The pagans lived in what we call darkness. That's from Romans chapter 2. They will admit they did. They will ask, they will say things like, oh, that I knew what I was doing was pleasing to one's God. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to please God. I don't know who God is. I don't know what to do. But I wish I did. Can we know? Yeah. We read this book. We know exactly who God is. We know exactly what to do and what not to do. I mean, exactly what to do and what not to do. So the question is, are we paying attention to it? Daily. We have a daily Bible reading, right? Are we taking it in? Because if we're not, then the pagans look better than we do. Again, comments or questions on this? Okay. Babylon, here in chapter 13, the oracle concerning Babylon. You remember the text. What's going to happen to Babylon? Just give me it.
They will decline.
They will decline, which implies that they will have risen. Because at this time, they're not even a blip on the radar, right? So they are a blip, but that's it. So they're a people. So far, they are a people that Shalmaneser deported, or Sargon, I guess, one of the two, deported from Assyria and over there to Israel. They're the Sumerians. That's what we call them. So right now, as far as we've read, these Babylonian people are captives in a land they don't want to be in. In chapter 20, which is, we haven't got there yet, in 2 Kings 20, there will be a vassal king, Merodach-Baladan, right? That's how you pronounce his name. Micah chapter 4, verse 10, a place where those in Zion will be exiled. We've actually already covered this in our study. But again, we read these three things, and we don't come up with, oh yeah, Babylon's going to be huge. But yet Isaiah knows. In fact, one way to state it, at this time there's no indication that Babylon would become a great power. How in the world did Isaiah know? God. It's simple. It's easy for us to say that, right? We say God. Yeah, God. God. Why? Because we understand that God works outside of time. And he can know it. I mean, it is so easy to say, well, it's a no-brainer. Listen to this. This is from Homer Haley's commentary. From this, and I'm inserting what he's talking about, or who he's talking about, liberal critics. From this, the fact that there is no indication in history that Babylon will become great, yet Isaiah sits and says Babylon's going to become great. From this, critics, liberal critics, reason that the prophecy concerning Babylon must have been written years later by someone other than Babylon, than Isaiah. Because obviously, according to them, Isaiah couldn't know it before it happened. What are they missing? The whole inspired thing, right? And it's so easy, right? It's so easy for us to say, yeah, they're missing it because of God. You know, this is ridiculous of them and immature of them to miss it, isn't it? Yes, it is. Now the question is, what about me? What about me? Oh yeah, I understand perfectly when God said what he said. See, their issue is with the when. No, he didn't say it then. He actually said it later. No. I believe he said it then. But what about the what? God gives me a prescription. He says, follow this prescription. And for whatever reason, I say, I don't think so. Am I any better than this liberal critic that I like to say, oh boy, I wouldn't want to ever be one of them? God says here, there's a pattern for this local church. What if I say, no, I don't want to follow the pattern? No, I don't have a problem with when. I understand when God said everything. What I have a problem with is what he said. And I am no better than the person who doesn't trust God in the when. I hope I've made that relatively clear. Comments or questions? Babylon. About Babylon. So this entire section. So we have Babylon here. We have the Medes up here. God addresses all these countries here, these nations, I guess I should say. We have Israel over here. We have Assyria over there. And then we have Philistia over here. And we have Moab down here. And we have Damascus right here. And then we have Samaria in there. And then we have Ethiopia, which is down here. And we have Egypt. And we have Judah addressed again. And in fact, Babylon is addressed again. And then we have Tyre addressed over here. I think that he's trying to tell us something about the whole world, isn't he? Because that's pretty much who that was at the time. All right. About all these people, three lessons. Now, if I get through these three lessons, I think we could actually move on from this section after these three lessons. The first is God's holiness. God cannot tolerate sin. Why did he destroy all these nations? Because they're sinning. All these nations, wham, do not sin. I was reading the other day, maybe somebody in here saw this also. I think it was Facebook. I forget who it was. I don't know. But there's a little girl or a little boy. I really don't know the details of this. This little person, small being, in a hospital. Major problems. In what I would call a clean room. In a room where no germs are allowed. Anybody, doctor, nurse, visitor, anybody who goes to see that patient first has to scrub down, get into the right suit, and then go into the room to be with this little, I think it was a girl. This is the same way God is. If you want to be in God's presence, guess what? You can't have any of on you. You're going into the clean room. And God says, look, my world is the clean room. And there's a whole bunch of sin in here, and I've got to do a detox. And so that's what he does. Secondly, God's fairness, as Gary pointed out, he even punishes his not only the pagans. Well, of course he's going to judge the pagans. I mean, who wouldn't do that? But then he takes his own people and says, guess what? I'm not only judging the pagans, you're my privileged people. I'll judge you just as well. And then God's control. He's got the whole world in his hands. That's what this section, I think these three things are the three major things that we can get out of this section. God does not tolerate sin. He will judge even his own people. And then he's got the whole world in his hand. For example, in chapter 18, when he's talking to Cush, chapter 18, verse 1, alas, O land of whirring wings, which lies beyond the rivers of Cush, which sends its envoys by the sea, even in papyrus vessels on the surface of the waters. Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared far and wide, a powerful and oppressive nation whose land the rivers divide. Now listen to this. Now he starts talking to the earth, the world. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, as soon as a standard is raised on the mountains, you will see it. As soon as the trumpet is blown, you will hear it. Okay, so the first part is, hey, you down there in Cush, go over there. And then he says to the whole world, hey, guess what? Look for this, wait for this signal, and when you see this signal, you're going to see what I'm going to do. But then he starts talking about himself in verse 4. For thus the Lord has told me, I, And the picture is God overlooking the earth, seeing what's going on, and waiting for the right time. I will look down from my dwelling place quietly, like dazzling heat in the sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. You know, you drive down the road and you look out and you see the heat just above the earth. What a wonderful illustration. And that's God is hovering. And he's waiting. Verse 5, before the harvest, as soon as the bud blossoms, the flower becomes a ripening grape, then he will cut off the sprigs with the pruning knives and remove and cut away the spreading branches, so on and so forth. So he's waiting quietly, which implies he is in complete control. The nations are doing, it looks like chaos. Doesn't it look like chaos? Yes, it is chaos. But from God's perspective, he knows exactly what's happening, and he's just waiting for the right time, and then he's going to execute his will. Galatians chapter 4, we see another illustration of God's power over the nations and in the nations. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. That expression, in the fullness of time, makes me shudder. I don't know exactly what it means, but I know this. God said, it's time. And he inserted his son into the world to save us. That's the kind of power our God has. Jonathan Bosworth said, I think it was this Sunday, it's one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard in my life, something like, the one who created time will not have any problem making plans. The one who created time will not have problems making plans. What are plans? Plans are manipulating what's going on in time. I created time. Guess what? I can do anything I want with what's going on in time. God is in control. That's what this map shows us. He says, look at this map. And then he tells us, I'm sitting here. I'm waiting, patiently waiting. And at the right time, I'm going to execute my command. He is in complete control of time and in time. With that in mind, turn to Acts chapter 17. If you were ever bound or predisposed to worry, I might suggest that this concept should put you at ease. Verse 26. He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundary of their habitation. So this God, who is in complete control of time and works in time and has executed his plans perfectly all through time, then takes you and me and takes us and put us all in 2016 AD. Should you be worried? But I mean, I've got my problems. John has his problems. Marcy has her problem. We've all got our problems. You know, our lives are so much different than they were back 2,000 years ago, aren't they? Even if they are, which I'm not saying they are, but even if they were actually different, would it matter? No, because God, guess who knows they're different if they're different? Guess who knows us? So you take a child, swimming lessons. Okay, child, first of all, you put on the life jacket, and then you take the child, and you hold the child either upside down, or it doesn't matter, hold it, and you say to the child, what? Trust me. Trust me. You're not going to like this. Trust me. And then you take the child, and you lower the child into the water, and what does the child do? Start screaming and kicking. God took us and put us in 2016. And what do? We scream and we kick. God's in control. Trust God. Comments? Yes, George.
Our man's impatience does seem to have a very significant impact on our ability to understand his purpose for us. You brought up Galatians 4, which I've obviously been looking at. And one of the things that I observed through this is that
As you're pointing out, in the fullness of time. Well, I mean, he's using the illustration where a woman impatient for God's fulfillment had her husband sleep with another woman, mm-hmm. you know, to try to fulfill however she thought God, you know, it's like I'm waiting to see, and it's the same thing with the Israelites, with the Christians, as Paul is talking to them now, dealing with these Israelites who are impatient for a fulfillment that must come within their lifetime, that they're expecting to look a certain way because they have to make it fit their impatience. That's a motivator for how they try to make everything else kind of fit, you know, and it's mm-hmm. not fitting, but hey, I want to see it happen, so what can I look at around me? And people do this now. Oh, earthquakes, oh, famine, oh, plague. It's some sort of fulfillment, mm-hmm. you know, and they're impatient to see something that, in that instance, has already happened. But they're waiting. They're waiting for something more, and it's not coming quickly enough yeah. for them somehow. It seems to be a big motivator in terms of misinterpretation.
Yeah, yeah. And when their most recent interpretation of some event in nature or in geopolitical world doesn't fit their interpretation of Scripture, well, then they just change it from Russia to China. Or now, I guess it's us, the United States. I can't keep up with it all, right? Okay, these are the three major... If I have a heart attack and die right now, I will feel that I have exposed this section well enough. There's a lot more, but these three huge lessons from this. Anybody else come up with anything else? What observations or applications can you make from our text? What can we learn from God about all this? Anybody? Anything? John, I know. I can... No.
I wrote down, God is in control. If you reject him, he will still prevail.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
Since you quoted it the other day, I've been able to make this fit everything. So, okay, for whatever it's worth, let the lesson be worth the pain.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You said that is great. That's one of the best things I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And I made it fit here.
Say it again?
I made it fit here. As yeah. far as the lesson goes.
Right.
Suffering all these things, let them learn.
Because one of the things we read that will happen is the Egyptians will come to know God, and there will be a road from Assyria. So are the Israelites and the world going to enjoy what God is about to do with Babylon and Persia? Are they going to enjoy it? No. But is the lesson worth the pain? It is worth the pain for those who will accept it. Yeah. That's a good quote of me. I quoted John McCarthy or somebody like that. I think it was John MacArthur, not John McCarthy, or Paul McCarthy. Okay, so about the day of the Lord. About the day of the Lord. In chapter 13, we're not getting far. Verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. Verse 9, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger. Okay, I have a question, first of all. Does anybody know in this text, carefully listen, in this text, can anybody tell me who the day of the Lord is applying to, and maybe even when? Anybody? Babylon. Now, why would you say a thing like that? Oh, it says it. Genius. I like the way you interpret Scripture. Do you know when, maybe? Say it again.
At hand.
Yeah, at hand. Or what are you reading out of today?
Your phone.
Your phone. Okay. So, yeah, my version says near. It doesn't matter. It's the same thing, right? I'm just curious. Yeah, it's near, verse 6. Verse 17, behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes. Who's that talking about? Cyrus.
Yeah.
Cyrus is going to come in. So, we know who and when. My point is, sometimes when it refers to the day of the Lord, you know exactly who it's referring to, when it's going to occur, and it's not talking about Israel or something in the future yet. Sometimes the day of the Lord. Now, I just want to build, I want us to get this idea into our head. I'm not going to go and illustrate it all the different times, like from Obadiah or other places. I'm just going to get this point into your head so that when we're coming across this term, the day of the Lord, we don't make the same mistakes some people do. Judgment on whoever. For example, Babylon in 539. How do I know? Verse 1, verse 6, verse 9, verse 9 and verse 17, right there. It doesn't get any clearer than that, right? Now, there's something else to look at this day of the Lord. What's going to happen on this day of the Lord? Well, let's read the first five verses. Lift up a standard and bear on the bare hill. Raise your voice to them. Wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. Okay, there's a call of nations to come to arms. Number one. Number two, this call is by God himself. You notice that. Verse 4. A sound of the tumult on the mountains, like that of many people. The sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. Okay, who can beat nations? What single nation can beat multiple nations? You can't. And that's the point. I'm gathering all these armies from people all over the world, and they're coming. And the point to a Babylon is, guess what? You're going to lose, and you're going to lose big time. That's what the language is. Verse 5, verse 4, the Lord of hosts is mustering the army of battle. They are coming from a far country. Notice they come from afar, too. And they're coming from the farthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. All right. So this army is called. This army comes from afar. It's an army that comprises many nations. And they are going to destroy. Then there's more language that we need to pay attention to. For example, verse 10. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises. The moon will not shed its light. Verse 13, therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. Okay, so here's an army. It's coming to beat you up. And guess what? The sun isn't going to shine, and the moon isn't going to shine, and the earth is going to tremble. And what is this talking about? It's talking about the day of the Lord that occurred in to Babylon, for Babylon, against Babylon, in 539 and thereabouts. My point is as follows. Watch for this. We're going to read this word, the day of the Lord, some 28 times in the Bible. Many read this language, especially when it concerns Israel, and look for a literal interpretation. They don't see it, and yet so they claim, oh, it's still going to happen in the future. For example, Schofield, on verse 19, verses 12 through 16, look forward to the apocalyptic judgment, see Revelation 6 through 13. So they read this, and they say, oh, it didn't happen. I didn't see the earthquake and the things shaking and things like that. So it still points to the future. But we already know that this text, no, it's obvious. If you let the Bible interpret the Bible, it just points to Babylon. And we understand from history and from the Medes that this happens in 539. So many read this language and look for literal interpretation. But here's really what God does. God uses the same language and the same imagery over and over again. He uses the same language and the same imagery over and over again to make the same point over and over again. But he applies it to different times, different peoples, different places, and different nations. One time he'll use this language of Babylon. Then he'll use it of Edom. And then he'll use it of the whole world. And then he'll use it of Israel. And then in the New Testament, okay, so this is from last week. This is my next chart. You guys missed it, Rick. You would have loved this. Don't bother to look at it too carefully. But remember last week we said, look, all these are also types of a yet future final judgment. So he talks, there's going to be a day of the Lord. And there's another day of the Lord. Oh, and here's another day of the Lord. And yet another day of the Lord, 1 Corinthians 5, 5, and so on. So we see all these days of the Lord. There's a day of the Lord for Babylon. And it came true. Did the earth literally shake? Maybe. No. But we're not looking for that, right? We're not looking for that. So my point is, when we read this, we're going to see similar language. We're going to see similar language. But here's one place where we can understand, no, he uses this language to say, their world is going to be upside down and over.
Their world?
Yeah. Right.
Quake. It looked like the stars were dark. Their world.
Right.
Their world,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if ISIS comes right now, is our world over? Mm-hmm. Exactly. The U.S. is not the U.S. anymore. It just ain't. Our world has been turned upside down. And all that language could apply. I say could. I'm not saying that God is necessarily using this language for us in 2016. Okay. A comment about their approach, the dispensationalist approach. getting and then adding. They get it and they add. They very often get it. I get it. And then they add. We talked about this the other day. Schofield on 13:1. Listen carefully. This prophecy concerning Babylon, chapters 13 through 14, announces the doom of the nation and city at the hands of the Medes, 13:17-22, but applies the word Babylon to the totality of the Gentile world power, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel 2, blah, 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 and culminating in the fourth world empire, Daniel 2, at the return of Christ to the earth as a smiting stone. All right. Now understand something. This verb is what he wrote. I didn't make a mistake, and I'm not missing a single syllable, not a letter. What's the subject? This prophecy announces the doom of the nation and the city in the hands of the Medes. I'm right there. But applies the word Babylon to the totality of the Gentile world, power being Nebuchadnezzar, coming in the fourth world, and return to Christ. What? Do you read that from this text? Did you get that from this text? No. You didn't get that from this text. This text, this prophecy, didn't apply the word Babylon to something else. It didn't do it. So either he's mistaken, doesn't know the language, and I barely know it, or he's a big fat liar. I don't know what. But again, he gets it, this prophecy concerning Babylon, I get it. And then he takes what he wants from somewhere else out there in the ether and plugs it in and says, no, it's also this. We've discussed that. So they so very often get it, which means it's gettable. We can get it. But they go on and add. Comments or questions? George, you look like you're...
I'm trying to remember here, but it might not be worth it to make the point. When he says the smiting stone is there, isn't he talking about a figurative language that is used in Revelation?
As the smiting stone. The return of Christ to the earth as the smiting stone. I don't remember right now where the smiting stone comes from. Anybody? Oh, yeah, Daniel 2? Oh, yeah, Daniel 2.
Because one of the things I was thinking about was how they refuse to see it because they don't want to take the language figuratively, which would make it easily apply to times such as Babylon. But then when they try to apply it now, they find ways to apply it figuratively.
Yep.
Again, where locusts become helicopters.
Yes, we saw one just the other night.
As you mentioned, so they won't take it figuratively there, because then it doesn't match their thing. But
right.
To make it match the thing, they still have to take it figuratively.
Yeah.
And as Gary was saying, that the whole world end, that's what they're looking for, but the Babylonians' world ended, and so now we get a volcano that blows up in Iceland, they go, the world's ending. Well, that's not the whole world, that's a volcano in Iceland. You know. So here they are, exactly the same way, it's consisting to different.
Yes, exactly. And so the thing is that I have to be worried about myself is being consistent. And watching out for being inconsistent, because I can fall into the same trap. They also, the difference is that I will admit, that I take some of it literal and some of it figurative, whereas they won't really admit that they take it figurative, but if you force them, then they have to. So we have to be careful about being consistent ourselves. Comments or questions? All right. There's a recurring theme in this passage that we need to look at. Come on, honey. Go. Chapter 13, verse 11. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. The arrogance of Assyria is why they're going to be destroyed. The arrogance of, again, Babylon. The arrogance of Moab. The arrogance of Israel itself. Arrogance, 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 arrogance. Can you think of a passage in the New Testament that says don't be arrogant? Although it doesn't say it like that. God opposes the proud. Right? James. Come on, this little thing isn't working here. No surprise there. James 4 and James 6. So, don't be prideful. Don't be prideful. So, think about it. What is a way that we can be prideful? Anybody?
Arrogant.
Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't even think of that. See, that's why it's good to have more people in class. Because, yeah, we're Americans and we're the greatest. We go loud. We go places, and we go to Austria and Salzburg and eat Big Macs loudly in the back of the tram. Really, it's so embarrassing, but it happens, right? And that wasn't in Salzburg, it was in Bratislava where Marcy and I were. Turn around and there he is. I'm talking loud. And, you know, it's so embarrassing. Anyway, so, we're Americans. Anything else? We're New Yorkers. Yeah.
We can be prideful here, you know. Look,
yes. Yes. Yeah, the Pharisees had the truth. We can be prideful. Oh, Numbers 15. Numbers 15. This word, presumptuous. Numbers 15. For some reason, I think I'm in the wrong. Yeah. Okay. Verse 22. When you, and my version says, unwittingly fail and do not observe all these commandments. The idea in verses 22 and following is, you might make a mistake. You might, I accidentally messed up. Okay, God can deal with that. But in verse 30, the person who does anything, in my version says, defiantly, whether he is native or alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that one will be cut off from his people. Some of your versions will use the word presumptuously. And in that word is two aspects that we need to think clearly about. The first one is, I'm doing something that I don't know I can. And the person who will do something who doesn't know he can is the person who is proud. And so we have both, when we say, he's very presumptuous. Well, did he do something that he can't do? We might not mean it that way. We will mean he's prideful. But the word at its base is, you're doing something you can't do. Who's going to do that? The one who's proud. So anytime that we do something defiantly, or might I add, we don't do something defiantly. God says to do this. You don't do it? Well, I'm no different than any of these people that we read about tonight. It's just a different manifest. What area are you proud in? Well, I'm proud over here. And that's true, right? Some of us are proud to be Americans, but the Russians are proud to be Russians. And the others are proud because we have a Bible and I know it. I know my Bible. Yeah, dog. Okay.
Paul several times says, let him who boasts
right
in the Lord. So if we're boasting of anything outside of that, I mean, boasting is kind of the outward expression
yep
of it, where pride can remain inside.
Right, we don't have to boast.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can be prideful. How am I being? I'm not obeying. I look like Mother Mary. Do you look at her and say, wow, she's a proud woman? No. But assuming she didn't follow some of the scripture, I think we're pretty safe assuming that. I don't want to judge her. But assuming that, then why not? Here, she's had the scripture all her life. Why didn't you obey it? And we run into Bible studies with people like that all the time. Test yourself. Am I following the commandments? A love for wealth. Chapter 16. This doesn't come out very much in this particular section. In fact, I think it's only kind of hinted at here. Chapter 16, verse 7. Moab will wail. And verse 6 is about their excessive pride, arrogance and pride and fury. So they're going to be punished. Verse 7. But look what they lose when they're punished. You will moan for the raisin cakes. They liked their lifestyle. They liked wealth. And so God hits them where it hurt. Verse 8, the fields of Heshbon have withered, the vines have, so on and so forth. He starts talking about all this. I'm going to punish you for your arrogance. I'm going to hit you where it hurts because you love your stuff. You love your stuff. But, of course, we don't really have to worry about that, do we? We don't have to worry so much about being caught up in riches. Right. Thank you for shaking your head no. Compare 1 Timothy 6:10. The love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. The threat is the love of money. What I find very interesting is that this person may not have any. Longing for it. They long for it. You can be rich or not and still love money. And what happens? You wander away from the faith and pierce themselves with many griefs. And we don't have to repeat that we have more money than any nation in history. That's you and I. Oh, we're the poor ones. We live up here where everybody in New York State's on welfare nowadays. Well, guess what? We still have more. You've seen, well, it doesn't matter. We have more. We have more. That should be our motto. We have more. So we need to be careful. In chapter 13, and then we're going to move on, chapter 13, verse 19 through 22, this is about Babylon. Verse 19, Babylon, the beauty of the kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, the jackals in their luxurious places. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. The question is, we asked earlier, when is this fulfilled? And it says in verse 17, I'm going to stir up the Medes. So we understand that this has some reference to 539. So I ask the question, when did it happen? 539? Because Babylon was still around for quite some time. Cyrus took it without doing what he describes here. Herodotus writes of it in the 400s. Alexander the Great conquered it in 331. It's still there. 200 years later, it's still there. How do we explain it? Well, first of all, the kingdom vanished, and it never returned. Who's heard of the kingdom of Babylon today? Right? It's gone. Over time, the city itself came to ruin. Seleucus I built Seleucia and moved the capital to it. That's around 275 BC. And if you go on Encyclopedia Britannica today, the present site, an extensive field of ruins, contains several prominent mounds. That's it. So did it come true? All they had to do was what? Oh, I'm getting at it. All they had to do was wait. All they had to do was wait. Sometimes God works this way, doesn't he? No, I think I'm just going to have you wait. What? Yep. You get to wait. That's your job. Waiting right now. By the way, our chart from last week. So sometimes, you know, these prophecies depict it just happening. Wham! Well, sometimes it doesn't really happen that way, does it? It kind of, you know, it's one of these things. It's going on. He is fulfilling it through time. Sometimes God works these ways. Now, someone said, my dad sent me a quote, he's trying to look up where it comes from. However benign a benign ruler is, be assured, he will rule. He's a ruler. God is benign, as in he loves. And he will rule. He says, look, I am going to destroy Babylon. Guess what he did? He destroyed it. It didn't happen exactly when we expected it to, or punctiliarly, like, bam, Babylon is destroyed. Not in our concept of time, but he did do it. So here's a question for you. Are you waiting for something to happen? God has said, look, you're going to... God says, if you read, you will understand. Really? Yes, really? Really? I just skipped this whole section because there's lots I don't understand in it. Slow down. We talked about prophecy last week. It's difficult sometimes to understand. Even the stuff that we can understand, it's difficult to work it all through there. I got an email from somebody later on and said, hey, maybe it's a good idea just sometimes when we're getting into that we get in the fog, we set it aside and come back to it later on. Exactly. God's not going to give it to you just like that. He doesn't inspire you directly. God says that, look, this word, if you read this word, what will happen to your character? If you read it and obey it, what will happen to your character? What should happen to your character?
Improve.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been reading this thing since 19 years. No, I mean, I've been reading it longer, but I committed to it 19 years ago. Marcy will tell you, it's not exactly having its full effect on me. Well, Paul will write to the Philippians, I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus. This is an ongoing, we're all works in progress. A child. A child is on a trip. So the point is, trust God. Trust God. He says, look, if you read, you'll understand. Okay, I'll just start reading. And sometime understanding will come. If you do this, you'll improve your character and become conformed to the image of Christ. Good, I'll do it. A child, you're going on a trip, camping, and they ask in Watertown, what? What do they ask?
Are we there yet?
Are we there yet? And you say, come on. We open up the Word and we read, and a month later we say, come on. I want to get there. Yeah, that's a good attitude, but be careful. Wait on the Lord. We sing the song, Wait, Wait on the Lord. Comments or questions? Gary.
You brought up a good point about when would it happen in Babylon.
Yes.
Am I getting too far ahead?
No, go ahead.
What about Damascus?
Go ahead.
When did it happen in Damascus?
Don't know.
Okay, I don't either. That's why I asked. Because of all the places that he speaks of,
okay, so I'm gonna take a stab at it, and I would suggest that the idea is Damascus represents Assyria or Syria,
okay.
and Syria is not the same Syria as is now. Rick, do you have a better answer, a more complete answer? Same answer. Yeah, and that's sometimes we got to leave it there.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what he's, and this whole section is full of a bunch of that kind of stuff for me. I don't know exactly what he's talking about. All I know is that whatever he said, and whatever he meant to say, he said, and it happened. Babylon, chapter 14. Chapter 13, Babylon, you're going to have problems. Chapter 14, the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel. This is happening throughout all of Isaiah. Remember, we say he goes back and forth with Isaiah goes back and forth. There's going to be problems for Israel. But then he says, but it'll be okay for Israel. And these are the two themes he has. Problems for Israel, okay for Israel. And really in this whole section, I believe he's also saying, guess what? It's going to be okay for Israel. Here, Babylon, you're going to have problems. Chapter 14, it's going to be okay for Israel. So Babylon's pain is Israel's blessing. Romans chapter 8, verse 28, we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God. Here, chapter 13, chaos in the world. Chapter 14, those of you in Israel who love me. Chapter 3, verse 10 says, don't worry. Don't worry, it'll be okay. Lucifer, we'll end with this. Who's Lucifer?
Depends who you ask, right?
Yeah, it depends on who you ask.
At the very least, the king of Babylon.
Say it again?
At the very least, the king of Babylon, right?
At very least, the king of Babylon. Yes, that's my tactful answer also. If you're going to stick with the scripture, who's Lucifer?
Babylon.
The king of Babylon. Right? Yeah, that's who he's talking about, exactly. So how did this end up? I don't read Latin. It talks about Quasimodo there. Quasimodo and then a whole bunch of stuff. And then I do read that word, though. Why do I read that word? Because that's where this word was inserted. Schofield says, this can be none other than Satan. It cannot be anybody other than Satan. Well, he takes it out of context, right? And as you pointed out, chapter 14, verse 4, take up this taunt against, and here he says it. It couldn't be clearer than anything. The king of Babylon. How in the world in verse 12 somebody goes and says it can be none other than somebody not even mentioned in the text? I don't know. I need to be careful that I don't do it. We're going to skip that stuff. God applies this to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar. Lucifer is the Latin word As a noun, it meant the morning star, which is what this word is. Oh, star of morning, or day star, your version will have, something like that. So they just took the Latin. Some mistakenly applied this passage to Satan. Now, here's the deal. This misdirect, and I'm suggesting it is a misdirect, is perfectly in line with Satan's methods and points. Who is he talking about? He tells us who he's talking about. The king of Babylon. But who does the world think he's talking about? Satan. Lucifer. Ooh. So the other day I was at the fair. Somebody came running up to me and asked me, where's the passage that says Satan was perfect? Satan was perfect. He was perfect with the angels of God. It wasn't this passage, it was Ezekiel. But that's not even talking about Satan there either. But how often do you get somebody running up to you, full of energy, demanding, I need this answer now, because I'm talking with somebody about something that's not even there. That's the problem with this kind of stuff. A viable lesson, don't be prideful. That's the lesson. That's the lesson, yet people are talking about something that is sensation, Lucifer. Ooh, the history of Satan. Guess what? It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter to us. How do I know? Because God didn't tell us, right? We can draw, make some inferences, but... Okay, we'll stop there. Any other... I'll stop there. Anybody else comment or question? Yes, George.
I'm about to sound really ignorant.
Good.
Even more than
you'll me. Join me.
Is it possible that I have even accurately read somewhere that Latin Lucifer word is essentially appears in the New Testament, but is translated completely differently and is referring to Christ?
Well, so there's 1 Peter.
Where it's essentially the light of the morning or the star of the morning concept exists.
Yeah.
The day star, yeah, that's what.
No, I'm in the wrong book. That helps. Yes, you're right. But where is it? Verse 19, 2 Peter 1, 19. We have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you do well to pay attention as to a lamp shining in the dark place until the day dawns and the morning star arises in your hearts. Okay? So if that's talking about Jesus, then yes. The only place that... Well, then the day star would actually refer not to Satan, but to Jesus. Yeah.
Revelation 22:16.
Yeah.
I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you about these things from the churches. I am the root and descendant of David, the bright morning star.
Yeah, right.
So Jesus refers to himself that way.
And I think those two words, well, it doesn't matter. Yes, Jesus refers
so
to himself.
The result that it's had on us is almost like the Easter Sabbath thing, right? I mean, it shows up one time, it's translated differently other places.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, confusion. So we need to pay attention to detail and not just do what we want. Okay.